Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Long before the Food Network stars and celebrity chefs were everyday names, a talented Southern writer revolutionized the American culinary world. We'll find out who that was and all about him when we come back on A Taste of the Past. Hi, this is Linda Palaccio, your host on A Taste of the Past here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And the man we are talking about, the talented Southern writer who revolutionized the American culinary world, was none other than Craig Claiborne. And amazingly enough, there's a whole generation of so-called foodies out there now who don't really even know who Craig Claiborne was. Amazing to me and to many other people. But he was truly the person who changed the face of how restaurants are viewed. Let me just quote a few people. Frank Bruni called him the father of contemporary restaurant criticism. The LA Times, Russ Parsons, said that he created the modern American food world. And Phyllis Richmond said he changed the cultural life of 20th century America. She said that in the Washington Post recently. And I have with me today the author who wrote a wonderful book on Craig Claiborne called The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat, Craig Claiborne and the American Food Renaissance. And his name is Tom McNamee. And Tom joins us today from Montana. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks very much, Linda. Glad to be here.
I stumbled through that beginning because there's so much to say about Craig Claiborne, and I'm so excited. And I did not have the pleasure of meeting him. Had been in the same room with him a couple times, but had not met him. But of course, his influence on me and so many people of my generation was enormous. And I thank you for writing this book because I think it explains so much about the man and about the American food scene. And let me tell a little bit about you. You're also a talented Southern writer, I must say. Tom McNamee was born in Tennessee but grew up in New York City, back and forth, right? And studied writing under the tutelage of Robert Penn Warren at Yale. And he's the author, well, a lot of people may know you from the book you wrote, Alice Waters and Chez Panisse. But you also wrote a lot of wildlife books, which we're not going to confuse that with a food issue today, but I think it's really quite interesting. You split your time between San Francisco and Montana, so I clearly understand that. But tell me, what drew you to Craig Claiborne and to write this book about Craig Claiborne?
It was a coming together of a number of things. I was reluctant at first because I thought that the story might be a little too simple. A Southern man comes to New York, becomes food editor of the New York Times, changes the food world, blah, blah, blah. That it would basically be a matter of simple research, writing it down and spreading it out. It turned out, I learned several different ways that the internal story of Craig Claiborne was just as interesting, if not more so, than his public history and his place in American culinary history.
There was a
meeting in New York in 2009, 2 days devoted entirely to Craig Claiborne, sponsored by the New School and also by the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at University of Mississippi. And everybody who had ever known Claiborne at the Times, people who could close personal friends of his family from Mississippi, they all came together for that, and I sat there absorbing all an astonishing amount of information over the course of 2 days. And I said, this man has to be remembered. He has to be brought back into the historical narrative,
right?
Because he's critical.
Well, and indeed, you did bring him back in force, I must say. And interesting that it kind of aligned up with the 50th anniversary of his first restaurant review.
Yeah, I've been getting some credit for that, and in fact, it was completely an accident. I should have known, but I'd forgotten when his first review actually was.
Well, we're going to backtrack a little bit and kind of educate our listeners, those who, because it's amazing, there are a generation of young foodies who really aren't quite so sure who he is. Oh, they may have heard his name in passing, but I want to read a quote from Jacques Pepin, and everyone knows who Jacques Pepin is. He said, "Craig Claiborne was the greatest influence of my professional life in America. Knowledgeable, dedicated, and driven, he was determined to better American eating habits." And indeed, he did. Craig, let's back up and talk a little bit about Craig Claiborne and how he first boomed onto the scene, if you will.
I think it's important to realize what the American context was at the time. This is just shortly after World War II. The industrialized food was in a huge upsurge. Women were going to work in numbers that had never been seen before, and therefore were not able to cook as much at home. And when they did, they often were using TV dinners and stuff like that. Mm. And this period from just after World War II up into the 1950s was an absolute wasteland in American food. I mean, it was pathetic. It was just, there was more and more frozen food, more and more canned food, more and more prepared food, and it was just dull, dull, dull. Nobody knew anything about authentic Chinese food, Italian food, even French food. There were French restaurants, but they were more or less bogus. And so Claiborne, after an extended adolescence that took him up to about 33 years old, decided that something needed to be done about this. He had been around, he'd been to Morocco and France and various other places associated with his service in the Navy, and realized that the isolation, cultural isolation of the United States was something he could do something about. And so he chose to go to the famous hotel school in Lausanne, Switzerland, the best in the world.
Indeed.
Where he learned not only traditional French cooking, but also service. He learned to be a fantastic waiter. He loved being a waiter. And as he gathered more and more knowledge about the food of the world, he thought, you know, where's the place where I can bring this to the United States most effectively and most widely? Well, the New York Times. At that time, the food editorship of the New York Times was always held by a woman. It ran on what was then called the women's page.
Yeah, they weren't.
And
yes,
there wasn't
it wasn't
much to it.
That's right. It wasn't
recipes
food.
Recipes people sent in little anodyne accounts of dinners out. But Craig had an idea that this could be a platform that could be used very differently.
That's right. I mean, it was more home economics than it was anything else, and he truly transformed those pages to become, as
exactly,
you said, food.
I mean, once he finally got that job, which was quite a story unto itself, he immediately started writing columns about cooking organ meats, about amazingly elaborate pastries, incredibly laborious things. He was bringing strange things to the New York Times readership immediately in his first columns in 1957.
Hmm. Well, how do you think that he really came to this? I mean, really, what was, Frank Bruni called it a formula in a way, that he found a niche and just sort of, you know, bore down on it. Was it just being in the right time, the right place? What about him in particular?
Well, as far as I could tell, and that's looking a long way back into the past, he really worked hard at preparing himself to make a big, big difference. He was very ambitious. Once he finally attached to an ambition, he became very ambitious, because he'd been very unambitious up to that point. He just didn't know what to do with his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he realized that scholarship and knowledge and know-how and expertise were going to be critical to being successful at what he wanted to do. He had a very big ambition to really change how America ate.
Well, it's interesting because there really were not any food critics as we think of them now, restaurant critics.
That's right. Before, there was no such thing as a restaurant critic.
I mean, there were restaurants.
That was one of the things he was looking forward to most.
Right.
And he was bitterly disappointed with the quality of restaurants in New York. He thought, oh, this is going to be great. It's going to be like eating in France. I'm going to go to all these wonderful grand French restaurants and give them great reviews. And, fish that was too old, vegetables overcooked, and fakery. There were restaurants that used chips of black olive in place of truffles.
Oh.
And he basically found only one restaurant in the entire city of New York that lived up to his levels of integrity and excellence, and that was Le Pavillon.
Mm-hmm.
A fantastically expensive, terribly snobbish restaurant, but a great one.
Well, there were restaurant, what I want to make clear is that there were restaurant reviews at that time, but they weren't critical reviews. They were mostly very favorable, more like advertisements, about.
Yeah, well, they were often just tied directly to advertising. And say, in Smith City, Missouri, somebody is opening up a restaurant and he buys a big ad in the local Clarion Bugle. Well, guess what? They send their restaurant writer to write something resembling a review. And you'd better believe it's going to be nothing but praise because, first of all, that critic is going to be getting free meals from then on out, editor of the paper probably also, and the restaurant owner is going to continue to buy ads in the paper.
Well, now,
so
this, right, and this
one
is...
one hand, you know, feeding the other.
That's right. And that's something that Craig Claiborne, he did have his own set of ethics, and he did not take... bribes or free meals when he went in.
Right. His integrity was absolute. It didn't help or hurt that he was working at the Times where there was plenty of money to pay for his meals, so he didn't have to take any freebies. I'm not saying he would have been corrupt otherwise. He wouldn't. But he did have fantastic opportunity to do everything at a high level of excellence. And it was always the tradition at the Times that the business department and the editorial department hardly spoke to one another. The advertisers in the New York Times, to this day, have no say over the editorial content of the paper.
Hmm. Well, what a lot of people might not know is he is the one who started the whole system of rating restaurants with stars.
He was the first to do it in this country. He really took it from the Michelin guys in France,
right,
which
had
been doing it for decades. And he started with the three-star system, just like the one Michelin has now.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, he upped it to four so that there could be slightly finer distinctions. He didn't do halves. He didn't do two-and-a-half-star restaurants the way a lot of critics do now. But his system of one through four was revolutionary, and of course it's now almost universally adopted.
That's right. He, just to show a little bit of his integrity with a newspaper and keeping up with something he started. He wrote for 29 years, a brief hiatus, but he was at the New York Times for 29 years writing reviews, and not just reviews. He also wrote about food and entertaining and recipes.
He worked amazingly hard.
Yeah, he had...
He in his first years, first 20 years, I guess, at the paper, he would be publishing 2, 3, sometimes 4 articles a week, including a rather long one, and one that required a lot of research and work, cooking, for the Sunday magazine. Meanwhile, he was gathering material for what ultimately became 20-plus cookbooks. His first one, the New York Times cookbook, had, well over 1,000 recipes in it. And several of his other cookbooks were in that range as well.
Mm-hmm. And the recipe...
traveling around the world, researching the obscure corners of New York. I mean, he was the first person to bring the attention of the sort of educated classes of New York to Chinatown, to Little Italy, to Spanish Harlem, to the Greek... area down along 9th Avenue. Those places were sort of beyond the frontier of your basic Upper East Side New York Times reader.
That's right. And not only these flavors of the outside world, so to speak, of France and other countries, he also brought to light, which is something that a lot of people might not be aware of, that it was due to him that food stars of that era became food stars, if you will. Julia Child, Marcella Hazan. I mean, he introduced these people, Mater Joffrey, Diana
Kennedy. He did, yeah. I mean, this was part of his philosophy from the beginning, was that it wasn't going to be just about restaurants and just about professional food. He always loved the idea of the home cook. His mother had had a boarding house in Mississippi with a cooking staff who cooked brilliant old-fashioned Southern food. And he loved the idea of finding these people who were, there were, you know, quite a few of them, who were cooking absolutely brilliant food at home, and then he would encourage them to professionalize. He encouraged Marcella Hazan to give cooking lessons. Mm-hmm. He encouraged Virginia Lee, the great Chinese cook, to give cooking lessons. Ultimately, he encouraged them to publish cookbooks, which, of course, they did. He collaborated with on the Chinese cookbook with Virginia Lee. And there were many of these people that we brought to the fore. First of all, I said he loved that restaurant, Le Pavillon. The chef at Le Pavillon, a guy named Pierre Frenet, who became his professional writing partner for decades, was in a dispute with the owner, and Craig decided to put the rather funny story of the dispute on the front page of the Times. And so Pierre became America's first star chef. Craig loved chefs. Chefs had always just been back in the kitchen. Nobody knew who they were. There was usually an owner who was out in the front of the restaurant in his little tuxedo or something. But the chef was a servant. And so Craig elevated the professional chef, like Paul Prudhomme or the Troigros brothers in France, to real celebrity status. And then he brought these home cooks and their brilliant work to the public. Diana Kennedy with her Mexican food, Edna Lewis's Southern cooking, as you mentioned, Mater Joffrey and her Indian cooking. And there are many, many of these, and their professional careers were launched.
That's right.
Almost exclusively in Craig's columns.
I can still remember some of the spreads, I'll call them spreads, in the page. He would just have, you know, he'd make sure that there was a beautiful picture of them, and there would just be a long explanation of their life and the type of cooking, and then a couple of different recipes. It was really, you know, quite, these people were very fortunate to have him writing about them.
He was a very generous-spirited person. I mean, one of the great examples for me was when his first cookbook, the New York Times cookbook, this humongous thing that made his fortune, and it's a great, great basic cookbook for anybody. It's actually what I learned to cook from, too. It was due to come out in September of 1961. He gets a call from this editor at Knopf saying she has this brilliant cookbook coming out, French Mastering the Art of French Cooking by Julia Child et al., and would he consider reviewing it? And he said, no, I don't review books. But eventually they worked out a deal where, because it turned out this editor, Judith Jones at Knopf, and her husband were great home cooks. And so Craig did a feature on them and their rooftop barbecue in Manhattan in return for reviewing Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volume 1, which he did. And he gave it an absolutely, you know, stunning, great review at exactly the time when his book was coming out. In other words, Julia Child's book was coming out also in September of 1961. And he sort of stepped aside to put her in the spotlight first.
Huh, that's interesting. We're going to find out some more about his life and in all of his hard work when we come back after a short break.
Night and stars that shine above so bright. Magic of their fading light that shines upon our caravan.
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
We're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm speaking with Tom McNamee, who is the author of The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat, Craig Claiborne and the American Food Renaissance. And Tom, in your book, you actually do talk about, I mean, Craig was so successful at the New York Times, and he really did pioneer restaurant criticism, and not only that, but he wrote wonderful recipes. You mentioned Pierre Frenet, and I have to say, I used to cook by their article. They would write a weekly article called The 60-Minute Gourmet, and together they wrote this, and it was fabulous, and I have to laugh now when I say it, because we have 30-Minute Gourmet, and we have 20-Minute Gourmet. Ah, the idea of 60 minutes, you would take 60 minutes to make a meal. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, today it seems unheard of. But tell me, how do you think that restaurant criticism has actually changed since his time, since Craig's time?
Well, he began the change very gradually himself, from these very small capsule reviews that would say something like, Pierre Larrey's French restaurant is a delightful place with excellent bistro food, and then there'd be the name and the address and the phone number. That'd be the review.
Huh.
Over time, they became more and more essays and about more than just the food. He was always very punctilious about the service and about the atmosphere. He didn't like to see a pencil sticking out of the head waiter's pocket. He hated the idea of ashtrays that weren't empty. Don't forget, everybody was smoking like mad in the day at that time. He began to talk about the place of the restaurant in a larger society. He would observe the behavior of people there, talk about the history of the dishes, and it just gradually grew more elaborate and more informative, and needless to say, longer, to the point where what we have now often in restaurant criticism are essays, in effect. I mean, you read the last several restaurant critics for the New York Times, they're talking about what shoes the women are wearing, and what have you know the bartender's quips, and a lot of details that are meant to tell you really thoroughly what the restaurant is all about. Craig, in his day, really still did stay focused more on the food, although as time went by, he also treated the social milieu as well.
That's right. Back to his pairing with Pierre Frenet and writing with him and the wonderful work they did together. He would always take us, they would always take us to, you know, a new place and experiment with new foods, new ingredients. And, well, in fact, you mentioned that in your book that he, Craig Claiborne, was responsible for introducing American home cooks to the salad spinner and the cuisine art.
Despite his training in which was in classical French cooking, as was Pierre's, he very early developed an interest in so-called ethnic cuisines, and I think probably the most important contribution he made to American gastronomic history was the internationalization of American interest. There's nowhere else in the world that there's so many different kinds of restaurants as in this country, or in fact probably in New York City, and that largely goes to him and his travels and his interest in not just French, Italian, Chinese, but Indian and Brazilian and African and Israeli and Vietnamese and Malayan. He kept constantly bringing in the outer world, and therefore a lot of things that we now take for granted, as we think, well, we've always had basil and pine nuts, haven't we? We've always been eating pesto genovese. Well, no, didn't happen until Craig started talking about this previously virtually unknown herb and nut,
right,
and the sauce made from them. Arugula, same deal, balsamic vinegar. Prosciutto, authentic prosciutto, had never been seen in this country. Creme fraiche, unknown. Vietnamese fish sauce, Nguyen Nam, a great Mexican ingredient, epazote. It goes on and on and on. Things that are now just part of our ordinary life, the fact that you can get all these different kinds of salad greens, even here at the IGA grocery store in Big Timber, Montana, population 1,300, I can get mesclun.
Amazing.
Kind of amazing.
Yeah. And the thing about Craig Claiborne is he was meticulous in his writing, his research, his proofreading. His recipes all worked, all of them. And
they do.
Yeah, and it's You know, so often today you'll read a recipe and they'll say, oh, oops, there's a correction. We forgot to tell you to add the, you know, the salt. But when in his work with Pierre, I mean, he would leave the cooking to Pierre, right? But he would be right there with his typewriter.
Yeah, he would be shouting it. Pierre cooked the way classically trained restaurant chefs did. He would just throw stuff in. And Craig would say, how much was that, Pierre? He'd say, measure it, Pierre. Okay, 1 1/4 cups. And so Pierre had the flair, the imagination, the creativity, and this, and amazing technical skills. And it was up to Craig to break those down into comprehensible, accomplishable elements so that he could lead you through the process of making something that might turn out to be, you know, you'd think it was difficult. It turns out to be quite a fancy dish. You know, it's got garnishes and a fancy sauce with a julienne of lemon peel and Grand Marnier in it. And he will have led you there, however, one simple step at a time.
Yeah. Well, talk about flair. The two of them went on quite an expensive dinner together that they, you can tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Back in 1975, Craig was had a rare evening at home. Put his feet up after dinner, was watching TV, and it was a fundraising night for WNET, the public television station in New York City. And most people, of course, turned those things off, but he was just sitting there exhausted, drinking his usual stingers. And up comes an item for auction, donated by America. Dinner for two, anywhere, no price limit. And he goes, whoa, no price limit. Bingo, gets on the phone, bids $300, wins, and calls Pierre and says, you can't believe what we have got. We can have dinner anywhere in the world, as long as they take the American Express card, and there's no price limit. And so they set out to find a restaurant that they thought could create the fanciest dinner they could possibly come up with, and it turned out to be a small place in Paris called Chez Denis, and they ended up having a dinner that cost in 1975 $4,000. The meal went on basically through three services. It probably took about 8 hours. They had ancient wines and cognacs. They had every rare ingredient in the world, and it just was almost unbearable to think of eating. And that, by the way, that $4,000 translates to probably $20,000.
Easily, yeah.
Current money. And he wrote it up. He didn't tell the times he was going. He sort of snuck off. And but they loved the story so much, they put it on the front page of the paper, and it was a scandal. Many of the readers were absolutely outraged at this extravagance, this waste, because this was exactly at the time when, you know, Vietnam War was just over. The United States had been humiliated there. New York City was in the midst of its worst fiscal crisis in its history. There was a famous Daily News headline, Ford the City Dropped Dead. The feds weren't helping at all. Crime was bad. It was just a bad time in general for him to make such a swashbuckling display of ego and consumption. And people went crazy. Allegedly, it was condemned. Craig always said it was condemned by the Vatican. I was unable to confirm that. It's possible. And then there was a great wave of reaction in turn in his favor, saying, hey, look, he's not taking food out of anybody's mouth. And Julia Child wrote him a letter saying, well, Craig, what a to-do. Would anybody have been writing letters from the Times if some rich bitch had won a Mercedes-Benz?
All in great style, indeed. You mentioned that he was sat back drinking his stingers. It is known that he did have a rather unhappy life.
He did.
Through all his success, he wasn't happy.
You know, it's hard to know how much to attribute that to the social situation of being a gay man at that time and mm-hmm. having to be in the closet pretty much. Of course, that was a strain on anybody. But I think Craig was also born with a sort of depressive streak, and he was very shy and tentative in his friendships. He was not quite reliable in his friendships. He's quite temperamental, and he was extremely insecure, which makes no sense at all, because here he was. He's the king of American food, undisputed. There was nobody else out there. He was the king of it, and he had an independent power center at the Times, had to answer to nobody. He had an unlimited budget.
He was
Everything in his life looked great.
Right, and he was a super host.
Just fearful and closed in on himself, and the way he dealt with that, there were two ways he dealt with it. One was to go ceaselessly to psychotherapy, changing therapists constantly, not satisfied, and the other was to drink. And he was a terrible, terrible drinker. I dug up bar bills from like one cruise he was on where each night he had 7 margaritas before dinner.
Wow.
That would stupefy most human beings.
Unbelievable. Yes, indeed. Well, you know, I wonder what, if he were alive today, what he would think about all the Facebooking and tweeting and Pinterest. And, of course, he was around for the advent of the Food Network. But had it not been for him, I don't know that these activities, and certainly Food Network or the radio network devoted to food, would really have been able to come into existence. Eventually, maybe somebody would have broken that, you know, the American culinary stigma of food was not important. But it was really due to him.
It's a natural outgrowth of what he was doing, which is lionizing the chef and making food, changing cooking from drudgery into fun, changing the nature of the American dinner party from where the housewife is isolated in the kitchen laboring over a hot stove while everybody else is having martinis in the living room. Mm-hmm. He opened it all up, and of course what we see now is it continues to open up. I actually think he probably wouldn't really love a lot of what's going on now, because it's reached the point, it seems to me, of a sort of frenetic pace, and so much food is meant to dazzle rather than to satisfy. Restaurants are so overcharged with noise, and there's so much excitement associated with food now, and I think that wouldn't sit well with him. He liked to have a calm, peaceful dinner where he could really taste the food, have a civilized conversation with his friends, and I think the sort of circus that we see represented on a lot of these contest shows on the Food Network would appall him. And I know that the noise in so many restaurants would be just intolerable to him. He'd walk out of the slanted door in San Francisco or any of a number of restaurants in New York that are just ear-shattering.
Yeah. Well, one of the writers who reviewed your book said that he became the gateway to culinary fame and was food writing's first rock star, which, of course, that was before the term had even rock star had been, you know, coined, that he was the first rock star. And indeed, he, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, he brought the chef out from behind the stove. And he did, in fact, create celebrity chefs. And now, of course, maybe created a few monsters, too, bigger than life celebrity chefs.
My favorite recent example of the sort of natural but unfortunate outgrowth of Craig's praise of chefs is a guy coming on to Chopped or one of those shows, and he said, and they had a little billboarding thing up at the front where each of the contestants was talking about how he was going to go about his business, and this one said, well, I think I've got a really good chance tonight because the lighting really agrees with my skin tone.
Ah! Wonder how it tasted. It is really, there's so much in this book that you explore and that you open up to the readers. And at the end of the book, I want to finish with something that you wrote, so fitting, because you say, "The world you transformed, Craig Claiborne, is the world we cook in, dine in, and talk about food in." And that is so true. And I thank you so much for all the work you did on this book and for joining me today on the show to talk about it. Again,
thank you, Linda.
It's Tom McNamee, and the book is The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat, Craig Claiborne and the American Food Renaissance. And you, again, have been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.